Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, states are passing legislation to bar teaching of critical race theory in public schools. But what exactly is critical race theory? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. For the last 6 months, several states have barred the teaching of critical race theory in public schools. Critics suggest this campaign is to eliminate discussions of race in classrooms. Others suggest that critical race theory is poorly understood by its critics. On today's show, we will discuss what exactly critical race theory is and what effects these campaigns barring its teaching will have on honest discussions on the history, sociology, and politics in the United States. Our guests today are Utz McKnight, Chair of the Department of Gender and Race Studies and Professor of Political Science at the University of Alabama. He is the author of Race and the Politics of the Exception, Equality, Sovereignty, and American Democracy, An Everyday Practice of Race in America, Ambiguous Privilege. Laura E. Gomez is Professor of Law at UCLA School of Law. She has taught the Critical Race Studies program in the law school's upper year curriculum. She is the author of Inventing Latinos, A New Story of American Racism, and Manifest Destinies, The Making of the Mexican American Race. She also co-founded and has served as the first co-director of UCLA's School of Law's Critical Race Studies program. And David Livingston Smith, professor of philosophy at New England University. He is the author of Less Than Human, Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others, and the forthcoming Making Monsters, The Uncanny Power of Dehumanization. Thank you all for joining us. Professor McKnight, let's start with you. What exactly do we mean by critical race theory?
I mean, there's no question it depends on who you're talking to. So if you mean we're all academics here, right? So in terms of how the institution has addressed the problems and politics of race, you would have, if you went back 150 years, ago, right? Deirdre Cooper Owens has written very nicely on this, the development of sort of the eugenics movement and all of this and obstetrics, right? 150 years ago, you would have had a conversation about race theory, right? So the idea of a critical race theory is let us be critical of this sort of more traditional way of talking about racial difference, right? As though those things are actually true, right? Or proper distinctions. So at the most basic level, I know I'm sounding as I am, an academic, right? But at the most basic level, the idea of critical race theory is the sort of constellation of beliefs that say, hey, we have to find a way to improve our society by coming up with concepts that basically address racial inequality historically in the United States and also contemporary racial inequality. So really, it's from my point of view, and we have a law professor here as well. From my point of view, this really, for me, it really began with Derrick Bell's work, Delgado, and some others. It's really a 1980s, 1990s project within jurisprudential scholarship, within the law school, with law schools around the country, as a way to talk about, let's say we have case law. You know, those are really stories. So you have like Robert Cover, Nomos and Narrative, you have these very these texts, these articles that are really describing how, you know, you could do counter narratives and counter stories. You could create, like if the law is based on, in a sense, storytelling, I know I'm being facile about it, but if it's based on storytelling, if you tell different stories, if instead you ask different, I won't go on too long. If you ask people who were otherwise, let's say in 1950, would you have asked the young Black girl, right, who has to go to the back of a store, would you sit there and interview and say, how do you feel about XYZ, right, in terms of race? It's lifting up those stories that otherwise have informed the law, but kind of bringing everything kind of an equal basis. So, you know, right now for me, there are three disciplines or areas of the academy in which something we call critical race theory looks very different, are sort of worked on. That's law schools, social work, and School of Education. Outside of that, the idea of using critical voices or voices that would challenge existing conservative ideas of racial inequality, everybody uses them, right? So I hope this is, you know, an easy way to talk about it. I know the other respondents have similar ways of talking about it.
And Laura Gomez, you teach in the School of Law and certainly have helped develop critical race theory for law. I think of a response I had heard in the early stages of these conversations that said that if your child is being taught critical race theory, you should be quite proud because he or she is likely in law school. So how much is critical race theory essentially a theory of law and ultimately is in the law schools?
Right. I think that's a great way to transition between Yute's comments and mine. And I endorse Yute's, your thinking about it. The one thing that I would add to that story before I go forward is, why did that occur at that particular moment in time, right? What is the political economy? You know, what is the situation in legal education that allows that to happen? Well, it is actually a affirmative action impact. The fact that there are now enough lawyers of color, in particular African-American, but others as well, who've been lawyers for a period of time, who then are becoming law professors, right? It's only at that moment in time, and it's a great example then of the way that who is in the club, who is at the table changes the conversation. When you look at those early critical race theory workshops, they were these, we called them summer camp, you know, and I wasn't at the earliest one. I'm a little bit younger. I started going in the early 90s, but the earliest ones were in the 80s. And you look at those pictures and it's people of color. And they were there because they needed that community because there was one or two of them at their school. Sadly, it's not all that different right now, but that was a real political moment. And I think we should mark that by understanding why it was people of color studying the law that then thought, really, we need a different theory. We need a different explanation of what's going on. But to get to your intro, Doug, when people are saying critical race theory today, they're not talking about what Yutes was talking about, right? They're talking about some bundle of very crudely labeled critical race theory. And for people who haven't read it, I commend the New Yorker article on Chris Rufo, how a conservative activist invented the conflict over critical race theory. And in effect, what he has invented is critical race theory as a kind of epithet. Right, as a epithet for the types of education and the types of inquiry, scholarly inquiry and K through 12 inquiry, high school inquiry, let's say, that conservatives don't like. So, you know, the advanced placement history teachers who are teaching from the 1619 Project. You know, I have a friend who is teaching high school in Albuquerque, and she was saying they hired someone new, and he learned in his graduate school of education training about critical race theory, and that the teachers are really excited because he might bring some of that into the classroom, right? And it would be in the form of, you know, explanation and kind of context of law and society, right? And law and politics and how we think about US institutions. It wouldn't be at the level of, you know, the kind of debate that I am preparing in my critical race studies, critical race theory rather course for my second year law students right now, right? That is really a whole different level, which is not happening. And it's a very particular kind of training that we're doing that I think you're very right, Yudes, to distinguish it from what's happening in education and in social work, which is all very legitimately critical race theory, but they've taken it and they've made something different, which is wonderful, you know, and it's not like we agree, right? Those of us who are, you know, in this field agree, but I think those are some good initial comments, I think, just to get us going.
And David Livingston Smith, you write and teach quite a bit on issues of, you know, dehumanization and questions of sort of setting populations up for atrocities. And so, I mean, at some level, I imagine you're probably teaching some forms of critical race theory, even if it may not be labeled in that way. Is critical race theory, at least the way it's being discussed today, really just about teaching race in the classroom, or is it something more specific?
As we've seen, critical race theory can mean different things. There's critical race theory in a very narrow sense, and we look back to its origins in legal theory there. Then there are varying degrees of expansiveness through that can be applied to it. In Yutz's very expansive account, I certainly teach critical race theory, but certainly not in a narrow account. I've not studied that literature, and I think it's very, very important not to use terms like this improperly in the academic sphere. So I'm a philosopher who is deeply, deeply, deeply engaged with issues around race, which is very, very intimately tied to dehumanization. And I teach a course on race and racism every year. In fact, it's coming up next semester, and I'm entering it with some trepidation because of the episodes of people calling for professors to be fired and disciplined if they, you know, dare teach the truth. So, I mean, that's the kind of boring response there. What I really want to do, though, is riff off of what Lara said, which is critical race theory, the term critical race theory, as it now lives in the media and lives in the public consciousness, has very little to do with what we academics are concerned with. Now, I didn't say nothing to do with it, because the fact is the sorts of things that we teach and we address are deeply threatening to many people, right? There is a connection, but it's a tenuous connection. Critical race theory, as it lives in the public sphere right now, is an ideological construct, right? It's an embodiment of what a lot of white people are terrified of and want as hard as they can not to see and not to address. And often, this is not the case here with us, but often I get a little bit frustrated with conversations with academics because, you know, they tut-tut and they say, well, this isn't really what Derek Bell wrote about or Kimberly Crenshaw. But that's kind of missing the point of the political moment.
Well, I think we can simultaneously be saying two things, right? One, you are mischaracterizing what this field is and what these claims are. And number two, actually, what we actually are about is probably deeply threatening to conservatives.
Exactly. Yes.
True conservatives in this country.
And not just conservatives, by the way.
Well, and when you were talking, I was thinking not just white people.
That's true. These are unfortunately all too handy labels, aren't they? I mean, there's a deep festering sore that I think the nation is nowhere near facing, nowhere near. And that's what's driving this campaign. You know, it's taken various forms over history. The latest form is the moral panic about critical race theory, so-called.
Hey, listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the issue of critical race theory and the recent legislation seeking to bar it with Lutz McKnight of the University of Alabama, Laura Gomez of UCLA, and David Livingston Smith of New England University. Uchi, we're going to respond.
I think we have to,
you know, we have a choice. We can address the idea of sort of, you know, a critique looking for a problem to fasten itself to, a sort of idea that persecution works as a politics. We say, we're persecuted, respond. Mm-hmm. And then you know, cobbling together some sort of thing that could, in fact, claim that, oh my gosh, yes, we are persecuted like that, and then working on it. And then everybody kind of follows along with that, right? This sort of invented thing, right? We have to distinguish between that, addressing that, and deciding that, look, do we have racial inequality in this country? If we do have racial inequality in this country, we have to, and we've had, you know, as Laura very nicely points out, we now have two or even three generations of scholars within the academy. We have 50 years. I was born in 62, right? Like, all of us are just starting out in this search for concepts and the idea of what democracy requires in terms of racial equality. So we can decide to address that and say, look, we need better concepts, keep working, right? Or we can say, wait, the persecution idea overwhelms that. We have to stop everything. Stop everything because it's a threat to, and then we wait, who is it a threat to? Like, we wait a second, we have to figure that out too. And I mean, this is, I mean, it's an anti-intellectual project. It's a political project, and that's what I mean by that, rather than an academic research-based. But also, this is where the academy, there's a lot of complaints about the academy, obviously, in many different ways. But this is one of the best things about academic work, is we're actually trying to figure out concepts that then could allow us to define discrimination, could allow us to argue that it's not your personal beliefs so much as how is this reproduced, these inequalities, right? And so if you take away the capacity of the one place where you do this research, the academy, to address these things, then you're left with kind of like, okay, let's shut everything down, right? And that's what this debate is. It's not so much that people are trying to do it, they're kind of forgetting that, rather than pursue the persecution thing and worry about critical race theory as it's now conceptualized. In some ways, we kind of have to do our work and come up with really good concepts and not be distracted. Now, we have to address it also, because it is politics, right? But let's not let it overwhelm our considerations, right, of how we could improve the society in terms of equality.
And I want to say something else on that point, Yutz, is that critical race theory from its core is not only about academic conversations, it's a political movement. You know, and that's something that was actually very upsetting when, to the early critics, the first generation of conservative critics, some liberal too, but mostly conservative critics who were writing against critical race theory in the late 80s, they were upset that it was avowedly political. You know, that we have a very particular point of view. We support greater justice for people who have been oppressed, right?
So let me riff on that just for a moment. So think about this. We've got the Civil War, right? Okay. And, you know, at the end of the Civil War, there's a group of people saying, oh my gosh, all of our privileges are going to be threatened, right? Like this. During the early decades of Jim Crow, we've got to guard our, like this, 1920s, 1930s, 1940s. I'm talking about the United States, right? The same thing. There are always people who are like, wait a second, Brown v. Board, wait a second. Any type of progress is going to threaten our livelihood, our existence, who we are, what it is to be American, right? So this is a variation on that. But it should be treated the same way that we treated it at that time, which is, okay, people, this is necessary for us to be America and to be democratic, right? That the expansion of liberties and freedoms and rights to all different communities, and no one is saying that we're not listening to you. But the fact is that if you persist in reproducing these sort of gross inequalities, we're not going to be able to have the society that we need. But it's very much like the way Laura's saying, you know, it is just a continuation of that same. It's a culture war. It's a, you know, but you can go back into Jim Crow. If you think, I mean, I'm living in Alabama, and, you know, Governor Wallace is standing in the schoolhouse door saying there will never be integration, right? Like this. And the, you know, that the stance failed was important to us as a society. Not that it succeeds. It's not a real threat, except sort of a manufactured thing as people are getting nervous. And David probably has a better answer to this. Like, why are people nervous?
David, I was going to follow that up because it seems like, I mean, some of the context here is my own interest in historical memory and, you know, rediscovery of historical narratives. You know, the Tulsa race massacre, and, you know, the other race massacres, that the narrative here is not a consistent African-American poverty, but African-American success with white rejection and white reaction against that. And so I guess, you know, part of this is how much is this criticism of critical race theory? History doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. Is one of the, and you have these similar responses.
Arguably, race, questions about race are the big questions for the United States, certainly. Elsewhere too, but especially in the United States, because we're really a special case. And the horror, the cruelty, and the wish to subordinate, as both Laura and Utz alluded to, it just reincarnates, right? It rhymes. It reincarnates, and it reincarnates because these matters are not grappled with intellectually and politically and socially. They're just not. Right? And this is hyperbole, but it's nonetheless significant, you know, every effort in this respect fails to go to the roots of the issues, every successful effort. And so it just keeps on simmering and bubbling and bursting out when social ecologies change in certain ways. So I totally agree with the bipartite view there, that there's us as academics attempting to theorize, attempting to understand, attempting to explain. And there's the political project. And that political project is not just outside of our classrooms, right? It's inside of our classrooms too. And these call for, they're interrelated, but they call for somewhat different attitudes. What sometimes concerns me is the penchant of some academics, I would say many academics, for not quite getting the political project, seeing this as just, it's a misunderstanding. It's a misunderstanding if we use that term very, very, very broadly. Let's say it's a motivated misunderstanding. And it's a misunderstanding that is motivated by the same forces that have motivated all of these events through American history. And it will take different forms. Once the critical race theory panic is over, something else will be the avatar of these issues. And as scholars, as thinkers, you know, our job, I believe our moral responsibility as academics is to really try and find deep ways of understanding and addressing. And part of addressing is a political component. It's addressing not just with the miserable, you know, little drop of water that we can reach in our classrooms, and we never know. If, you know, we don't see many people 5 years down the line, or in our writings for other academics, but in our engagement with the wider world as well. And I say as well, because all of these efforts are significant.
Laura Gomez.
Thank you, Doug. I just want to name the particular things, though, that were happening that triggered this particular moral panic.
That's good.
And we have to understand that when you have the kinds of crowds marching in the streets over police violence against Black and Brown people, particularly men. And you have that ongoing galvanized public, and you have them yelling about systemic racism, right? And that coupled with the pandemic and the fear and the dislocation that people are experiencing, coupled with, you know, the first time in American politics that we have avowedly socialist democratic candidates and elected officials in AOC and Bernie, right? You know, just all of these things coming together at the same moment. It's a real crisis moment, and something was going to be the target, right? Something was going to be the target. And I think there's one other thing that I just want to put on the table, and I'm sure you three know it very well, but this also fits within an ongoing attack on higher education, right? The anti-tenure people, people who say that we, you know, the four of us are brainwashing their children and charging them money to do it, right? You know, and I think it fits within that was already a frame that Tucker Carlson and friends were pursuing. And so that helped ignite this moment as well.
When we come back, in this new battle over critical race theory, what exactly do we mean by race? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The controversy over critical race theory has led to several states passing legislation to ban the teaching of it in public schools. What exactly do we mean when we talk about race, and how should it be taught? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing critical race theory, the role of academics and educators in teaching about race, in teaching about power, in teaching about history, and the impact of a campaign banning critical race theory in public schools. Our panel today is Utz McKnight of the University of Alabama, Laura Gomez of UCLA, and David Livingston Smith of New England University. Now, Utz McKnight, one of the things I find particularly fascinating about these conversations on race, and this is not an original observation on my part, but one that seemed fairly compelling to me, is that scholars on race and activists on race really have not agreed fundamentally with what the sort of the racial charge is. How much are these racist and racial indicators, structural indicators, versus kind of personal attitudes about race? How much is this about structure, and how much of this is about individual, you know, individual thoughts, individual approaches? So in the criticism of critical race theory, which in my mind tends to focus more on the structural questions necessarily than the individual ones, how much of this is, when we're speaking about race, we're really just talking past one another as to what we mean by race?
Oh, absolutely. So let's take a step back. First, let's acknowledge that we have, as academics, we probably have five or six basic schools of thought on race, right? There's no question about that. Just like feminist theory, there are many different schools that come from what for many people would think of as esoteric traditional differences, right? But let me break it down. So you have an individual in the classroom, because David before this was talking about the classroom. You have an individual in the classroom, and the person says like this, well, how am I supposed to address this? I know that there's housing segregation, educational segregation, employment segregation. I know this in my life. I come from an affluent suburb outside of DC. We had one or two Black students in my class all the way through high school. As we went through APs, those two hung on. The person could be one of them or could not be one of them. It doesn't really matter. But they say, how should I address this, professor? And the professor goes, well, you know, you have to take your own person out of it, ironically, right? You both have to consider your own experience, right? And your own descriptions as a way almost into the problem. But then you have to see how is this reproducing all over the place? And also, you mean well, right? This student, right? The 18-year-old goes, I really want to do the right thing, right? I don't see myself as a bad person. I know I'm not supposed to speak a certain way about people and all this. They have this apparatus, right? Start. And the professor goes, you know, you both are there in the moment when you go to the bank and you get, you know, a mortgage, and you're both part of the reproduction of the inequalities that you see, but you also have to worry about your social interactions, right? And then you have to worry about how does it reproduce across generations as well, right? And then wait, what's reproducing across generations? Because each of these collective units, right? We say white and Black, Asian American, et cetera, you know, in the United States, right? Indigenous, et cetera, you know, Latinx, right? We go ahead and we say these things like, wait a second, these are incredibly diverse. And the person, this is the 18-year-old, goes, yeah, you know, light-skinned Black guy from Oakland, like this, what do I have in common with, you know, the person who grew up outside of Selma, who's Black in Alabama, right? Like this. But everybody's looking at us and saying, hey, you're the two Black kids in our high school. Mm. And you're like, oh, crap, I shouldn't have moved here, right? You're like this. So the professor is sitting there going like, look, we have all these set pieces that all have to be theorized and worked on. And then on top of that, we have a description, a legal description of discrimination and hate speech. And then we have these movements as well. And then you have to worry about the police. Right, like this and all this. And so you have institutions, you have all this complexity. And so therefore you get academics who work on different pieces. And you have people who, from their position, in terms of what their interests are, if you were doing prison research, for example, you would come up with a number of theories and ideas. And in addition to this, right, in contrast to, let's say, you did corporate brain drain, elite hiring and recruiting, right? Okay, is your interest, right? Okay. But in addition to this, you would have other groups of people within, let's say, just the Black community who say like this, well, you know, I'm from Puerto Rico. You know, you're from Oakland, but I'm from Puerto Rico. Or actually, you know, my dad is from Ecuador, right? And it's like this, wait, and then all of a sudden the person says, yeah, and you know, more than half of us are women. And we've got 90% poverty in the community, but you, Dr. McKnight, you're not impoverished. Well, okay, right, like this, right? So all of a sudden we get something like intersectionality, okay? So there are people who work on those types of ideas too, right? So it's not a coincidence that those of us who are doing the academic work, but also those who try and get a handle on a sort of narrow description of a field of research on race. And remember, you have the traditions of, let's say, feminist theory, Marxist analysis, liberal democratic theory. You have a whole bunch. You have more than that, right? Okay. You have disability studies. You have queer studies. Every sort of entity body of work for the last 50 years explicitly, but of course, a lot longer for Marxist analysis, right? All of those then have a stake in this as well, right? So those actually form the traditional schools, the differences and all this. And then wait, I have to include this because Laura Gomez is in law school, right? And David is a philosopher. I'm a political theorist. Each discipline has their own thing and each subfield has their own thing. So what we then, is it a coincidence then that we have confusion and then about what race might be and how it might be defined all over the place all the time, a sort of grand theory of race, right? And wait, it might be that that's actually healthy. that it's actually healthy to have all these different perspectives, especially when people are saying diversity. Well, that's what this looks like. So we can, I know all four of us could argue viciously about what our description of race, blah, 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 like this, right? But we would kind of stop and kind of go, you know, and this has been the rule for me in my years. It's like, look, if we can find one that works, we're great. Because, you know, right now we're facing almost the same types of inequalities as we faced when I was born in 1962. So we're not succeeding. And so a critique of this, the critique of this search, of the project, you know, sounds a lot like somebody saying, hey, you know, that's enough equality. No more, no more people. And that's something that we're not going to be able to accept as a country.
And Laura Gomez, to kind of build on one of the things that Professor McKnight was talking about, is sort of what is this construction of race? I know the work that you've done speaks about race as a construction, you know, the social constructions of race. In international relations, where I teach, you know, the general school, we call constructivism, the idea of concept, you know, being constructed. So with that in mind, I mean, when we're speaking of race, how fluid are these concepts of race? You know, how often do they change over time? And what are some of the meanings that are attached to those changes?
That's a really big set of questions. You know, you mentioned I do teach at the law school, but I also have a PhD in sociology and an appointment in the sociology department and in the Chicano Studies and Central American Studies department as well. And that idea of the social construction of race has actually become very prominent in critical race theory, because when we think about how is race constructed, how do we either come to have ideas as individuals, or more significantly, as a society, right? What do we understand as people who are non-white and people who are white, both ideas that are changing, right? That have changed and are continuing to change. We have been very deeply influenced by the work of Howard Wynant and, Michael Omi. Racial formation in the United States has been a tremendous influence in critical race theory. And so the constructivist position, you know, is something that was very challenging to lawyers, right? Because lawyers, thinking about constitutional law, one of the ideas was race is protected and has the special status under the Constitution because race is immutable. Right. And we don't think that way. You know, when my students come to me in law school, they don't think that way anymore. Not to say that there still aren't vestiges of that in many ways. And maybe particularly, I think, on the right. But we are thinking more about how is it that legal institutions define races, right? And so I teach a number of cases. I have one unit that focuses on Louisiana because Louisiana has some of the most interesting racial history. And I teach several different cases, you know, one from family law and one from wills and trust and one from civil rights law that basically the courts of Louisiana working through, is this person white or not? That's what courts have done. And that's, you know, so I think that thinking in terms of the constructed nature of race is incredibly important and ongoing. And it does sometimes threaten the leftist students as well, right? Because they kind of chafe at that sometimes too. So it is, I think it is one still very much up for debate how that is shaping out. But in terms of my own work, I look at the shifting nature of Mexican Americans and other Latinos in that kind of black white system that we primarily have here.
And David Livingston Smith, when I'm thinking about, you know, these questions and sort of what we're doing in the classroom, at least, it seems, I mean, the way I tend to present in the classroom, first of all, is the questions, I want to teach you how to construct the questions, and then you'll wrestle with the answers. And so how much, when thinking about whether it's critical race theory, or Utz has done a wonderful job of highlighting all the different areas, whether it's race or gender, intersectionality and class, et cetera, is it about sort of teaching the students how to frame the questions? And I also find myself frequently saying, that's a legitimate international relations question. It's a legitimate, legitimate area. And so when I see this criticism of critical race theory, it seems in part what they're saying is, you can't ask the question. And that's what I really chafe against.
I think in a way, what I try to do with my students is even more basic than that. It's to help them see that there are questions to be asked. So I manage to squeeze race into every course I teach. There's always at least one class, but the course which is devoted to this topic, which is called Race, Racism, and Beyond. My aim is, I'm not interested. Let me start that a little bit differently. I'm not interested at all in students leaving that course and knowing the difference between, Charles Mills's view on philosophy of race and how that relates to Lucius Outlaw's view on philosophy of race. I don't care about that. What I want to do is open students' eyes to a problem. Most of my students, not all, but almost all of my students are white kids. It's, I teach in Maine. So open their eyes to a problem. Give them ways of thinking about that problem and talking about that problem, right? And they tend to be ill-educated in all of these areas. So the very first step, the first 2 weeks of class, sometimes a little longer, we just do history because they don't know the history. They know the cartoon version of the history. They have no idea how horrible the history of race has been. So when we get through that segment, and I do it chronologically, I use a lot of films. Part of the reason for that is to counter students' skepticism that Smith, the liberal professor, is making this stuff up. So then they're in a space where they're thinking, oh my God, I had no idea. This is awful. Well, the next step is showing them how one might think about race. Now, this is a very traditional area in philosophy of race. It's known as the metaphysics of race. It's really concerned with the question, well, are races real? And if they are real, what kinds of things are they? And there are basically three options historically: biological realism, which hardly anyone outside neo-Nazi circles accepts now, social constructionism, and what I call anti-realism, right? They read some papers on this. They're presented with the pros and cons of each view. I try very hard not to influence them with my own take on this. I'm sure I'm unsuccessful in doing this. In my teaching, I try to avoid the standard language, because what I found is often students, they've gone to various courses, been told how to speak, but they don't have a comprehension. So I never talk about social construction when I'm teaching. When they're reading, I talk about invention. Is race an invention or not? And then we can make the distinction. Well, some inventions are real, like money and marriage and stuff like that. And some inventions are fictional, like Bigfoot and Harry Potter. So how does race fit into that? Once they have that, and it's a great relief to them to have a way of thinking, because, it's just like when race comes up, the panic buttons come on and their minds get paralyzed. Then we can look at theories of racism. Well, we're talking about racism. What are we talking about? And we can see there's this range of views. And finally, the beyond, where we address everything from reparations to the cognitive psychology of racial bias. I found it works. And, you know, we could start with a group of very defensive students, understandably so. And by the middle of the course, they're okay using terms like white supremacism and so on. They're actually relaxed about it because they've got something to stand on.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the campaign to bar teaching critical race theory, the impact that has on understanding about race and the education of students wrestling with questions of race in society and history and law in the United States. Our panel today is Utz McKnight of the University of Alabama, Laura Gomez of UCLA School of Law, and David Livingston Smith of New England University. So this last segment, I really like to think about sort of where do we go from here, considering we've got this campaign and we've got these, I think we would all agree, a dictate as educators to want to at least introduce students to these questions, you know, to these concepts and empower them to be able to research, critically reason through a number of these issues in the case of Flora Gomez to practice law and being able to, you know, wrestle with these. So I guess it's a kind of simple, deceptively simple question. I'll start with you. What do we do at this point in history when faced with these sorts of campaigns?
And obviously there are other ways to look at this, but I think we should see the current type of anxiety around an idea of race as symptomatic of the larger sort of politics of race in the country. And so we have many unaddressed questions. So in that sense, there are two things that I think are very important. One is that we continue to do the research and we continue to support the research. And you can see this with the sort of bifurcation within the academy, with lots and lots of interest in specific things, for better or worse, right? However you feel about them, everything from implicit bias to the problem of discrimination to like this, to then structural racism, the way these terms, and then this critique of teaching about race at all. How should we do it? How should we teach it, right? Is this something that is making people dislike themselves or feel guilty or something like this, right? You can see this, I mean, it's very obvious. This is symptomatic of where we are in our time, holding our time in thought, that we have a particular type of nexus or point in time where race is something that we have to address, right? So if you keep that in mind, in other words, we must continue to argue about these things and talk about them and research them. You then also can see how individuals have to orientate themselves as persons against the frame of this conversation. Mm-hmm. And so what I would like to do is to, as very much how David was speaking before the break, right? This idea of you can address the idea of criticism and how society progresses and improves is what I mean, right? Not, you don't necessarily have to talk about race as a concept first. Instead, what's a student? What's a teacher? How do we learn? How do we teach, right? What are we really doing in the university? So yes, it is, you know, in that sense, a question about the role of all the institutions in society, but it means that you can address the 18-year-old and say, look, take a step back from your own experience. Mm-hmm. Keep that in mind, keep the experience in mind, because there is a place for that too. But we actually have in common a concern with this. All of us have a concern with this. And that's where we can actually move forward and mm-hmm. communicate and develop. And so when somebody comes along and says, my way or no way, we should all recognize this. We're, those of us who are older, right? This is just a particular moment. It is not actually the truth. It is somebody is galvanizing things and saying, this is the authentic, this is the way it should be. This is like this, right? And I think we should be nervous about that way of stopping conversation and acknowledge that even if it's very difficult, and a lot of people say it this way, we need those difficult conversations. But in fact, that's kind of what we're doing. That's what we've been doing in the US now in my 58 years of being alive. So, you know, when I was, you know, I was born 62 in Oakland, California. The Panthers came up a few years after that. Black Power movement, all this, we've had historically in my lifetime, all these changes. When I was born in 62, my mom, you know, is a white Swedish woman, and she was married to a black man. In many states in the country, they could not legitimately have been married. Mm-hmm. You know, so, you know, obviously that's a crass way to talk about it. Yeah. But even in my own lifetime, right, the U.S. has been party to an incredible amount of change, right? I do think that one of the things that's going to become more prominent in our conversation, rather than listen to like, stop the conversation, will be this idea of we need to talk about the different way the communities interact, right? The different ways that wealth, assets, poverty, et cetera, are important. The politics of ableism, the idea of disability, the queer community politics, right? We need to talk about sexuality. We need to talk about the environment. We need to talk, like, there's all these different things that in going in that direction within the work on race will be fruitful.
Or Gomez, your thoughts, where do we go from here?
Because I can't compete with it, I'll take it in a different direction.
I forgot gender. Put gender in there.
which is just to say that I feel like we're kind of in a very bifurcated moment, right? Where at UCLA, we're doing great. I have 41 students enrolled in critical race theory and 26 on the waiting list. Students are not afraid to take this course, but you know, at other law schools and other faculty who aren't tenured and where they don't have a critical race studies program, people are maybe being told not to teach the class, or maybe they're not going to make the class because they're not going to get enough students, because students are afraid to have it on their transcript, right? And go into, you know, corporate law interviews, law job interviews with and hear about it. And so I don't want to leave without coming back to the political moment that we're in. And the fact that it is a political fight for some people who are already being fired. And so what does our response look like then? What should it look like given that we have, you know, there are those of us who have tenure and who are secure in our employment. And there are many others who may really be threatened because of the states that they live in, or the particular employment status they have, or the fact that students in their institution are not going to be willing to take their courses. So maybe that's a topic for another day on Scholars Circle, but I'll leave it there.
Actually, a wonderful topic for another day, and I'm certain we will revisit that. We've got about 2 minutes left. David, your thoughts about sort of where do we go from here?
I'll be brief. We keep on keeping on. That's where we go. We can't see the future. We're doing the work that we think needs to be done. We keep doing that. Now, Cornel West likes to say, and it's something I've adopted from him, I'm not optimistic, but I'm hopeful. The idea being it's worth trying. We don't have to anticipate a quick good outcome or a good outcome at all. But what we're doing, what we have been doing, is something that is intellectually and morally and politically necessary for us to do by whatever means in our various disciplines, and our various orientations, we do it.
I'm actually heartened by sort of two observations. The first is that my own students certainly seem to be more aware of these issues than I was when I was their age. I do have quite a bit of faith in each generation coming forward, you know, their openness to learning. They have a response. One of the reasons why I decided to become an academic is when I learned something I didn't know before, I was both amazed and then angry. Why didn't you teach me that in my history class before? And decided to pay that forward. But the other thing I think of, and taking into account what Laura said about employment issues, which they are certainly very concerned with, sometimes if you tell a student they can't take a class, that might be precisely why you have the wait list. It's because that's why they want to take the class. Because if
at UCLA, yes.
Yeah, it might depend on the, you know, on the culture of where you are. But I think this we sort of conclude this with a sort of important message about teaching, being cognizant of what we're teaching, realizing we're in a political community. And I think the one thing we would all agree on is that what we're doing is not just in the classroom, but also in society. So the accusations that we are all in the ivory tower is more certainly of a mindset. And I think increasingly academics are understanding that we need to break out of that ivory tower and need to engage the community. I want to thank you all for your incredibly thoughtful responses and some tremendous insights into this extremely important issue. We've been discussing critical race theory, the campaign against critical race theory, the broad concepts of race, and its impact in the classroom. Our guests today have been Utz McKnight. He's the chair of the Department of Gender and Race Studies and professor of political science at the University of Alabama. He's the author of Race and Politics of the Exception, Equality, Sovereignty, and American Democracy, and Everyday Practice of Race in America, Ambiguous Privilege. Laura E. Gomez, she is the professor of law at UCLA School of Law. She has taught in the Critical Race Studies program in the law school's upper year curriculum. She is the author of Inventing Latinos, A New Story of American Racism, and Manifest Destinies, The Making of the Mexican-American Race, which is in its second edition. She also co-founded and served as the first co-director of UCLA School of Law's Critical Race Studies program. And David Livingston Smith, professor of philosophy at New England University. He is the author of Less Than Human, Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others, and the forthcoming, he tells me in October, Making Monsters, the Uncanny Power of Dehumanization. Thank you all very, very much.
Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The Scholar Circle team includes Doug Becker, host, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Tim Page and Mike Hurst, engineers and technical support. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.